Hello and welcome to Power of 10, a show about design operating at many levels of Zoom, from thoughtful detail through to transformation in our organization, society, and the world. My name is Andy Pollane. I am a design leadership coach, designer, educator, and writer. My guest today is Alan Colville, a design leader helping government, public, and private sectors think differently to find human-centered and design-led ways to thrive. He's been an independent consultant since 2006 and is currently helping the UK Met Office design their data services. I met Alan recently at the Service Design Global Conference in Helsinki, where he gave an excellent talk about embracing conflict, which really resonated with a lot of the conference goers. Alan, welcome to Power of 10.
Thank you, Andy. It's really it's a privilege to be here.
So I want to talk about the talk because it really did resonate with a lot of people. It's been one of the ones that many people have listed and said it was one of my favorite ones. But before that, just tell us a little bit about yourself and your journey to where you are now.
Okay. So I'm going to pick out just some, I think, transformational moments because I've been doing this for quite some time. I'm a designer by qualification. My degree is in graphic design, actually. And I started working mostly in print, loving the smell of paper and the process of printing and really enjoying that. But of course, the internet started to happen, didn't it? And I realized fairly quickly I was being asked to design things that I didn't fully understand the interaction around. So in 1999, I went and did a master's in interactive media was the title of it at the time, but it had a lot of human-computer interaction. And I think that was the point. I can clearly remember becoming user-centered and it being the thing that I carry through and the red thread essentially throughout the rest of my career and what I do mostly today as well. From there wasn't anybody in Ireland where I'm from doing, I guess, usability, information architecture. So I harassed a company in the UK to give me a job, and they did. They're CX Partners, who are still based in Bristol. And that was a huge change for me because I began to see the possibilities and work with other disciplines and see the work getting carried through. And from there, working in an agency, of course, around 2001, we had the dot-com boom and things started to change and all agencies then started to let people go. And I moved from there and took up a position in a cable company in-house, which was, you know, some people considered to be an unusual move. They understood that maybe I'd continue agency side. But I think the 4 years I spent in that company were transformational. I had a role as a commercial manager, but I was a commercial manager with a superpower because I saw things from a user-centered point of view in 2002, 2003, when not everybody did. And it gave me a way of really developing products that had impact, actually. And then within the organization was identified and rose very quickly as somebody that could do something and deliver things in a way that worked. From there, the next most important piece was I was headhunted to go to BT, so the British Telecom, because they were designing a TV service. So their first foray into TV. So I was heading up the customer experience team there. And I think at about a year and a half into that, I was pretty much burning out. I had, you know, done roles, risen really quickly, but felt it wasn't quite working for me in a huge organization, trying to be user-centered. It was really hard. It was like trying to steer a tanker. So I decided to leave and was offered gardening leave in case I went to a competitor, which I took, and my wife took as, let's go traveling for a while. So the three of us, my wife and my 18-month-old, went traveling for a year. And I think that was really transformational for me because I think I hadn't the balance right in work and life.
Yeah, yeah.
Hadn't really seen my 18-month-old. But that allowed me then to kind of crave that flexibility. So since then, that's 2006, I've been an independent consultant working for myself in, you know, mostly in private sector, I would say. But actually in the past 7 years, and this is another transformational piece, wanting to work for organizations with stakeholders and with purpose more so, and less for shareholders. But I remember coming into government and public sector and being really surprised by design. It didn't look, sound, feel, work as I knew it. And I think actually that was the point where it started to surface, how disagreement was entirely different, how harmony was valued over constructive disagreement. And so that was probably the biggest challenge I had. In addition to the pace was very different to private sector, or, you know, for agencies where you're working on pitches and it's really high paced, high measured. Yeah, and that kind of takes me to today, where I'm working still for a government organization using user-centered design to help them understand users better and deliver better services.
And out of that kind of the pace difference, I mean, slower in public services, or you said different?
Yeah, slower. I definitely think slower. So you have to adapt to that. Inside work and outside of work, I'm quite energetic. And I think I had to think about, well, what do you do with that slower pace? What are the things that you can focus on in addition, because you're moving slower? And that's where I started to think about the more human qualities, actually, that you can spend a little bit of time, because I guess in the higher pace, you're focused very much on the practice, the primary and secondary, the competencies and stuff, but less time to engage, because actually it became, if you're moving slower, keeping people engaged, keeping them moving with you when you're traveling at a slower pace. And sometimes it can be glacial, and just managing yourself to know that, to accept that's okay. And sometimes actually in that context, trying to rush is really detrimental, because the culture and people are not ready. It's not how they currently do things. But yet you need to move fast, because organizations need to change. And if they take too long, then, you know, there's a risk and a threat there, isn't there?
There is. I mean, there's that perpetual change thing that happens as well, which I think if you know, I'm not a fan of speed particularly. I think that whole kind of obsession with velocity has been problematic, you know, because it's been inherited from mostly from, you know, Silicon Valley startups, right? And they're where velocity is important. But for a lot of large companies, I think often getting it right is, and or organizations getting it right is more important than speed at all costs, at least. But there is obviously the flip side of that, which is that sort of glacial pace. And there's a thing that happens where, you know, we've spent 2 years doing this transformation, and then, you know, new CEO or new somebody comes in and goes, oh, well, I'm not doing any of the stuff that last guy did. We'll do some other stuff. And it is often, that's quite gendered often. It is often a guy saying that about the previous guy's stuff. And, you know, I knew a company in Australia, a telco. I won't name which of the two it is, but they went through this whole process. It took them like 6 months to do their budgeting process for the year, right? So they were in the middle of the year, just got it all kind of sorted. And then the CEO brought McKinsey in. McKinsey did their restructure, which meant firing a load of people, basically. And McKinsey forced them to do the budgeting process all over again. So literally, they were like 10 months into the year and they still hadn't fixed their budget for the year. And it's impossible to really work in those kinds of conditions. And so that stuff happens a lot. There's definitely a cycle. So your talk, let's talk about your talk. We talked earlier, and we ended up doing that thing where we ended up talking for ages before the show. So now we have to repeat some of it. But there was, we talked about your talk about conflict, but we were talking about a thing that I talked about actually, which was how much your family circumstances, how you grew up, certainly family, school, culture you grew up in, they shape a lot, an awful lot about how you deal with conflict. And you started your talk with a personal story. Do you want to...
Yeah. So I think I've had to, in my simple brain, put together how to have better conversations, because I didn't have role models, for example. So my mom and dad, you know, I told this story, valued harmony in the house. They took pride, bless them, like I love my mum and dad to bits. They took pride in never arguing in front of us. And I remember, you know, having relationships then as you grow up, and having disagreements and just not having the tools, just having to, you know, I'd shy away from it. I would avoid it at all costs, which isn't healthy. And it doesn't progress things. So I think almost the talk was me recognizing that you have to have better conversations, which involves having constructive conflict and piecing together how would I bring myself to a point where I could broach subjects, where I would lean into it. Luckily, as a designer, you're kind of taught that, right, as part of your degree. You know, critique is a really important. You're always taught that you take it and you build on it. So I think that was really useful for me, but it still didn't give me the day-to-day nuance, I guess, of dealing with disagreement with colleagues, for example, or even with, you know, with partners as you grow up. So, yeah, I think that's where the talk kind of stemmed from, my own inner work, as you called out in your talk, which I absolutely love. But it's funny, isn't it? As designers, we start with, okay, so I'm going to look at this thing and I'll understand it, but I'll look at how it affects other people. But the more I went through it, the more I realized it was my inner work. It's actually me and what I bring to the table, because that all comes into play when you disagree with someone. It's not just about the topic you're disagreeing around, it's how you disagree and your approach to it. And that's where I realized, you know, as a designer, maybe I've not set the conditions for that to happen well, because I haven't considered even the words that I use, the tone, the approach, the question you ask, that opening question to open up a discussion and create space. And then, you know, that really hard bit, actually, which is being prepared to change your mind. I think almost as a designer, we're taught that, and particularly service designers, actually, were often looked to as people who have answers to lots of different things. But being able to say and going into a disagreement and hedge your claims, don't start by trying to prove yourself right. So, yeah, like that's quite a shift. That's a reframe of how you approach disagreement, isn't it?
It is. It is indeed, yeah. There's something that's just become apparent to me that is now really obvious now I can think of it. You said something back before about sort of taking something, looking at how something's made. And there's a classic thing. I mean, you do it as a graphic designer or as a media designer. We used to do it. I studied film, video and interactive media and photography. But there's a classic thing that, say, you know, industrial designers, product designers do, which is, you know, the professor comes in with a vacuum cleaner, like a, you know, a Dyson, and says, okay, take this apart and understand how it's made. And you take that thing apart and you have the students take it apart and have a look at it. And they go, oh, this bit's injection molded. And, you know, this bit has been designed in this way because for efficiencies or whatever. And here's where they save some money. And you really do that. You really can deconstruct it and understand all the parts of it and understand and try and do the reverse engineering of thinking, how did that become that way? And why is it done in this way and so forth? And what were the decisions made? You know, and I try and get my students to do that with services, which is a bit more difficult because they're intangible quite often. But it just struck me, the thing that seems like really obvious now that I think of it is doing the same with interpersonal interactions and doing the same. So obviously what my wife as a psychologist does all the time, but really intentionally doing it in the work environment and saying, okay, there's a conflict going on here. And instead of like, oh, conflict, we don't want any of that. And we can talk about the generational thing later on, actually, but doing that thing of like, no, I don't want that. That's, you know, that's triggering me. That's traumatizing me. But actually looking at it and going, well, let's have a look at what's going on here. Let's pull it apart. Let's look at it as we would any other designed and or designable object and understand it, I think is maybe a useful way for us to get our heads around the idea that it's not an awful thing to do, but it's actually a very designerly thing to do.
Yeah, and I think, so if you said that and applied that, it's in organizations, that's not how they run.
No.
You know, organizations are, you know, there's lots of research to say that organizations are not doing their best thinking because they truly don't know how to handle conflict. And I gave some statistics around, even at an exec level in Europe and the US, that execs shy away from, avoid, because, you know, they might fear of getting embroiled in conflicts that, you know, they don't know how to manage because they don't feel equipped, or maybe even they think that they would lose. So even at that level, and then you think about employees as well, you have to think then about, okay, so what's my part to play in this? How might we have better conversations, understanding that the norm is probably to avoid them? So then the only way you can lean into that is, you know, you as a designer, what you bring to the table and how you might encourage better to start to set a tone and model that, rather than thinking, oh, I'm going to have an change the organization to having constructive conflict. You know, that's not the starting point, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. And the more and more I kind of think about impact, and the whole conference we were at, the theme was impact. The more I think that the greatest impact we have is, I mean, obviously, really like the stone in a pond and the ripples, is those really close to us. And that ripple effect, I think we underestimate actually of what a difference that can make. And even if it's not in the organization you're currently in or for the next few years, often, you know, you will be the role model for someone else. And when they end up in that position, they end up affecting quite a few people, you know, anyone who's reporting to them if they're in a leadership role. And so that can have a massive impact. It really can have a ripple effect. And when I talk to people in coaching, you really hear it's one or two people in their lives who've made a massive difference. It's quite often, for a lot of people, it's a teacher of some kind, either at school or university, who saw something in them and kind of gave them permission to step into their own power in that respect, or showed them that design was a thing. But quite often it's just one person who really, it could be someone they worked with, could be a boss who just really unlocked something or just gave them a role model for something. But that goes both ways, obviously, Mike. So people have a kind of terrible role model of someone. Well, I say a terrible role model. They have a role model of someone acting in ways that are very destructive, but that also often gets them promoted. And then that becomes a thing too. And I think that quelling of conflict can often be a very sort of dictatorial approach in management.
Yeah. And I think the challenge is really, isn't it, our psychological drive to, you know, not have interpersonal discomfort or to rush over conflict, you know, these habitual things we do when we're faced with it. It's kind of, you talked when we spoke before this about reprogramming. I think there is an element of reprogramming here that you've got to do, starting with yourself. And, you know, how do we as designers not jump to a solution? I think we're better at that. You know, we try to surface assumptions, which should create disagreement that would allow us to get to better forming, better outcomes that we can work to. But, you know, we are human, and we do, you know, want to be proven right. We want to be seen as. So like that reframing and reprogramming is really interesting. But from going through this process, and I've been kind of applying this for some years now, it is hard, but it's simple as well. Because these are things you can do. I was using some of these techniques, just simple framing statements to just try and have better conversations where there wasn't good conversations. And it's amazing once you have some courage, show a little vulnerability, how others react. And the room changes as well, doesn't it? Because you find, oh, I'm not the only one, because of course you're not the only one. If there's something that's feeling, you're feeling it's not being said, you know, others feel it too. So, you know, it can be really positive to be the one that kind of just says, hang on, you know, there might be a better way here. And then others go, yeah, I was thinking that too. And it's like, it just changes everything. Or even you say something that people disagree with and you don't get resolution, and it isn't solved, but you've had a disagreement, and that might be the first time you've had a real disagreement in a team. So the next time you have it, maybe you're better placed, or you just shifted the dial a little bit or lent into it a little bit more. So it's a better place to have it next time. So I think just saying those things and getting them out there, even if it doesn't get to the outcome that you'd hoped for, is still better. Because, you know, I've presented this talk before going to Helsinki, and someone in the audience said, it sounds like an awful lot of work. And I'm like, yeah, it does sound like a lot of work, but think about the lack of motivation. Think about the negative energy. Think about the dissatisfaction. Think about the team and how it can deliver impact when you don't surface those things and you just leave them there and you carry them and they just remain. I think that's worse. But again, in organizations, we like to quantify and measure things. That's really hard to measure, that we should, you know, create some sort of playbook for designing with conflict, because it actually, you know, the return on investment is this, you know, we're far away from that. But I think on an emotional, you know, energy level, I think it makes more sense to surface those things than it does to actually leave them.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think it's also, I mean, I think you could quantify some of that stuff. One of the things that happens in consulting, and, you know, this isn't unique to Accenture, you know, it happens in loads and loads of large organizations, large enterprises. But what I found, I was really surprised by the amount of alignment meetings. Right? And I was like, what? We need an alignment meeting on this. And I said, what the hell's an alignment meeting? And what it is a group of people dancing around each other, circling around each other. It's a bit like when dogs meet each other and they are, and you get that initial moment of like, are we going to fight or are we going to play? And we're not quite sure. And so there's this kind of circling around each other and everyone is talking around the project. And usually there's a lot of jargon in there, because jargon is a great way to cover up all sorts of insecurities and questions that nobody really knows the answer to and everything. And then eventually what happens is, by some kind of osmosis, it's like a kind of systems effect where the group of people align, and at least they think they do, and now this is our purpose and direction and so forth. And quite often that is an illusion anyway.
Yeah.
But there's you know, a deck has been created. That's usually one of its aligning things. But, you know, it can be like three or four meetings. There's quite a lot of people who are paid quite a lot of money to get there. And if people had the confidence to say, you know, I'm sorry, what are we doing here? I don't really understand what we're doing. When you say we need a vision strategy roadmap, what is that? I don't really know what that is. And there we would get very, very much, much quicker to some kind of result. And I think one of the sort of design superpowers, which we forget all the time, is to make abstract things like that tangible, you know, to draw a diagram or to, you know, to draw whatever it is, you know, it's a concept or an idea, and to actually sketch it is a very, very powerful thing, because then you get out of the fact that telepathy doesn't exist and everyone's kind of pretending to know what the other thinks, and you actually have a concrete thing that you can disagree over too, but you at least you both know you're looking at the same thing and you're disagreeing over it rather than thinking you're aligned and you're not. I mean, how often does that happen where you get this moment where everyone thought they're on the same page, and then as soon as something gets made manifest in the project, it's like, oh no, that's not what I was thinking of at all.
Yeah.
And trying to get there quicker is really important.
Yeah, I think I remember it from the conference, somebody talked, instead of alignment, to talk about cohesion. And I thought that was really interesting, because it says an awful lot more, doesn't it? But what would you need for cohesion would be different to what you would need for alignment. For example. So in putting the talk together, one of the things that I tried to stay away from was a toolkit.
I'm so tempted to ask you, it's like, what are three things you need to do?
Yeah, because actually I think it's more fundamental than that. It's more foundational. It's more words, being so powerful. And the framing statements you could use to elicit some of those assumptions that you feel are in the room. You know that they're in the room. You know there's beliefs, particularly at the beginning of a project or even some way through. You know, and you can feel when there's beliefs that are not coming out. Maybe a sketch or a visual thing as designers, but sometimes just a reframe, just a question can be enough to start a conversation that might result in, oh, does it look like this? But I think the interesting bit is, like, how would you flip that to make that more open for input from people who maybe don't want to pick up a pen and do a sketch, for example. Yeah. You know, great with solutions architects, and for instance, they're happy to do a process flow. I use an exercise which I've been using for many, many years, and it's a stick figure exercise, and I've used it with Zex, I've used it in boardrooms, I've used it everywhere, and it's beautifully simple in that everybody can do a stick figure. So I guess it's thinking about, if you are going to use a tool, how do you leave it as open as possible to input? A really good, you know, I don't know, even the simplest, like, let's start with outcomes as a question, is really good at reframing. But that six-figure one is, like, really useful because it's got only six boxes. So it forces out a priority. You ask people to start, you know, thinking about a user going through it. So it then starts to build empathy for users. And you ask them, you know, to the sixth box needs to be the outcome that they want. So even in that, and I've had people sketch out stick figures with ties and high heels and all sorts of stuff, but I've never seen, you know, in when I've used it, I've never seen, you know, initially people go, well, I can't sketch, you know, but it's fine, you know, everybody can do a stick figure. But I guess, you know, that's the lowest fidelity, but that's as much as you'd need sometimes to surface disagreement, isn't it? But other times it's like, it's more complex than that, so you need to put something together that really brings out some of the complexity in that, and that might be a diagram or a tool. But I try to, in the talk, I was all the time resisting my urge as a designer to whip out a tool and say you could, and because it didn't fit, I was like, because I knew it wasn't about our practices, I knew that it's about our human qualities. So that's very much about our language and our attitude and our mindset, which is, I guess, where the core of the talk came from, was that, and, you know, the idea that it's embraced the conflict. And I had those stickers that people keep asking me for from it, because I do think it's a mindset shift that you can do at any time, and you could start tomorrow and just try.
Yeah, I think we talked about this a little bit before in our previous chat, that there's also this, well, there's cultural differences and there's also generational differences. I mean, so I'm British and I lived a long time in Australia. I live in Germany now and I teach in Switzerland. And I've taught in Australia as well. I certainly noticed differences when I first went to Australia about critique culture, for example. And I don't know if it's unique to the UK, it may be true of the USA. It's pretty hardcore in the UK when you're at university and you go through a design crit. There's no holds barred. In Australia, I really found there was a tendency to avoid that conflict, or to avoid being the one who put yourself out there a little bit and say, you know, well, I really think this didn't really work so well, because there's a whole cultural thing about what they call not being up yourself. Yeah. And so that, but that ended up in crit sessions, people going, yeah, I like it. And I'm like, but why? I just think it's great. But why is it great? Or why is it not? And getting that out of people. You're Irish, so you were talking about, and now you live in the UK. What have been your sort of cultural experiences around the differences in the way people approach conflict or avoid it?
It's really interesting, isn't it? I love this.
We're going to make loads of generalizations now, right?
Just tons of generalizations. So I think you can jump to, and I think this was the third section of my talk, was talking about supporting others. And a lot of that is about maybe some of the beliefs that you're bringing into a disagreement around your cultural background or somebody else's, actually. But we often do forget about the thing that trumps that, which is our family experience. But let's just start with cultural background for a second then. So I'm Irish, which I think gets me a long way into disagreement. Something about the accent, for example, which people like, once you're understood, that is. I do remember coming here when I moved here first and meeting somebody that I'd been working with for about 3 months, and they were in a different office in a different city. And when I met them in person, they were like, oh, you know, love your accent, but didn't understand the word you were saying. So, you know, that can be an issue. But I think that's something that I bring to the table when I'm disagreeing with someone, and that comes into play. And sometimes that can be beneficial, because maybe I'll, you know, the accent gets me some of the way. But I think in the UK, people are not as willing to disagree. I think it's more healthy in Ireland because we're very self-deprecating as a nation. And it's, yeah. So, and then, you know, I've got a brother who lives in Italy and his Italian wife. You know, healthy disagreement is such a part, and it's so interesting. I was with him a little time ago, and to see when he interacts with us, you know, he's not I guess he's Irish, but when he's interacting with Italians, it's like a different person, because of course he's been living 20 years, so he's taken on, and it's like much closer proximity to people. You know, like, you know, I'm really careful not to kind of stereotype here, but you know, it is a lot of, like, it's not just verbal, it's
full gesticulation going on.
and you don't know, I don't understand the language. Are they upset? No, they're not. It's just that's how they express themselves. But you know, so I think there is a cultural thing for sure that, you know, is good to consider, but also don't just consider who's in front of you and their cultural backgrounds, actually consider your own and start there. And then there are benefits that you can just think about, right? You know, how can I kind of better not utilize? Because I hate to think that you're thinking about this as some sort of persuasion. That's not what it's about, actually. It's just about, because the most important thing is, when you're working in a team, when you're working in an organization, regardless of cultural background or family experience, you just want everybody's opinion. You just want people to be heard. What you don't want, either from a senior stakeholder who maybe has an idea that you've not managed to get out, or from a team member, you just want to get those ideas out. That's the most important thing, regardless of background or family experience. But what it does really help is to think about cultural background, maybe. But if you can get underneath it a little bit and think about somebody's family experience, and I explained a couple of techniques to do that, asking simple questions in your team, because we know that when people share a little bit about their family experience, they're more likely to share in other areas, because that's all you're trying to do, actually, is to set up a space where people can feel they can share and you can get everybody's opinions, because we know best opinions don't always come from designers. They come from every place and you have to hear them.
Yeah, it's funny when you think about a lot of the methods used in workshops, they're often used to deliberately flatten out the hierarchy in the room or to get different kinds of voices. And if you think of that round robin exercise, and people don't know, it's an ideation exercise where someone ideates something. And then the next, you pass your paper, it's like the consequences game, you know, you pass it around to the next person and they are called upon to critique that idea. And I've had it once in Japan, in fact, where, you know, hierarchy is very strong in business culture, where the person was sitting next to the CEO, and had they not been given the instruction of, well, now you have to kind of critique this piece of work, they probably wouldn't have done it. But it was, you know, it's very healthy. It's really useful to do that. I find the culture things always fascinating. And obviously, you know thyself is really the rule here of, you know, what do I bring? And it's so tempting, you know, certainly when you're younger, I think, to assume that your cultural norms are the norms, right? I've got a really funny little example of this, actually. There was a TV show in the UK, and it was all about generational cooking and recipes and how people cook like their parents and grandparents did. And there was a woman who was saying, you know, I always cut the, like, I don't know, cooking a ham or something like that. So I always cut the kind of corners off of the ham or the kind of... And so, well, why do you do that? Well, it's just the way I cook a ham. And then asked her mother, and her mother said, "Why? Well, it's just, my mother used to do it, so that's why I always do it." And they asked the grandmother, and the grandmother said, "Oh, well, you know, it never used to fit in my tin." And so, so they're taking on this thing. I am someone who likes, I like vinegar on my bacon. And I thought it was a thing that everyone did. It just turned out my dad did that. I suspect his dad did that too. But those kind of examples are really, you hear it over and over again. When people actually start to excavate their own sort of cultural norms. And then a lot often those things get embedded in methods as well. So, you know, having done lots of workshops and stuff in other parts of Asia, for example, it becomes very, very clear of how North American a lot of design and European, a lot of design methods are for sort of workshops and facilitations and things, and they don't necessarily translate into other cultures. But that said, I think you can lean into your own culture. I mean, you said about the Irish thing. I've definitely had a, there's definitely an excuse when I'm in Germany or in Switzerland to say, you know, it may be because I'm British, but can I ask this really stupid question?
Yes.
It's not really a stupid question. It's, you know, can I ask the question elephant in the room, which I think you can make use of. And I've also had a, I think it's a nervous tick of mine probably to sort of be a little bit joking and kind of dad jokey in interactions with sort of senior people. But I found it very useful because I found a few times I slipped into that kind of court jester role. And the court jester was there to tell the king the truth that everyone else would get their head cut off of, for saying. And it's been super useful sometimes because I felt I could then, I had the license, I think. Yeah. It gave me some confidence, but a license to say the thing that everyone else was thinking in the room, but didn't dare say. And say it in a way, which maybe is a very British thing to have this, it could be interpreted one way or the other, to say it in a way that, you know, it could be interpreted as a joke. If it, you know, if it landed badly, but it could also be taken seriously and start a conversation. And I think there's a there's an awful lot of service you can do where you understand, you know, what role can I play in this sort of social dynamic? What am I good at doing? You know, sometimes it's bringing people back down to earth. Sometimes it's bringing clarity. Sometimes it's bringing some humor. Sometimes it's bringing the kind of personal in. Everyone has their different skill, I think. But I do think everyone has a skill.
I completely agree. So it's interesting, Andy, because one of the doubts I had before giving this talk was I knew it was an Irish person working in the UK, and this was a global conference. So I was like, will any of this land actually? You know, is there, are any of these things universal? And I think I asked that question in the very beginning, you know, has anybody had issues or concerns at work they're afraid to raise? And the whole room put up their hand. So that was like, that made me instantly happy and sad because I wasn't sure that, I thought maybe it was culturally specific, actually. So I didn't see how it would land, but it seemed to have, it definitely hit a note, didn't it? The talk itself was very well attended, and I've been inundated, if I'm honest, since. So there's something there, and there's something for us as service designers. There's something about how we better have better conversations. There's definitely a feeling, I think, if I'm, because I've looked back to some of the things that people have been probing me about, and it's like it is looking for, you know, better ways to deal with, but it's not about, you know, have you a tool? It's more about how would you broach, how would you ask, how would you? So it's simpler, isn't it? But really important.
Yeah, this comes up all the time in coaching, actually. And there's often I think I talked about it in my talk. There's often a moment where someone's having a problem like that. They're having an issue with someone that they work with, and it's often a peer as much as a boss or, you know, someone you know, working for them, and, you know, they're really wound up about it. And eventually, you know, and I listen, you know, so they rant about that for about 10 minutes or something. I say, well, what is it that you really want to say to this person? And I get the version of it with lots of swearing. You know? And then we kind of go, well, but my answer is really, or my question is really, then why don't you say that? And what would it look like if you were to say that? And then they make the non-sweary version of it. But it amazes me how scary that is for people to then go off and say it. But invariably, when they've had the courage to then say it, and it's helped them to rehearse it, I think, in the coaching.
Yeah.
You know, including what's the worst that could happen if you say this and what might happen otherwise. And then they have it. And often it's not only resolves some of the conflict, it can quite often really be a very, it's like the first argument in the relationship, right? It actually then bonds them much better with the person that they've previously been in conflict with. Have you had that experience or similar?
Yeah, that's exactly it. And that's, if people understood that, were willing to take that risk, you know, and I think, you know, not just because people do ask me a lot about, okay, so, but hierarchy, you know, surely that's, you know, the biggest problem. But often our disagreements can, you know, are with peers or with people in different teams, not always with disagreement with management or an exec. That's rarer, actually, because that's more about the strategy going in the right direction, which isn't actually about disagreement, that's a direction. So I've absolutely had that, and I'm having that all the time. And I've yet to have, and this is me being really honest, to raise something that didn't feel right or that was maybe worrying about or demotivated me or made me feel anxious, and not had the other person, you know, step into a space that made us better connected afterwards, even if we didn't get to, you know, some, you know, perfect resolution. The trust that was built with just raising that and you know, being humble and vulnerable and exposing yourself and just saying, look, I'm feeling this, it creates that space that is, yeah, so it's worth doing. It really is worth doing. But you need to approach that with a mindset that is, if you're looking, and this is the kind of checklist, if you're looking to be proved right, then that's probably not going to go well. But if you're looking to truly make a better connection or work better, and if it's in the interest of work, and if you're prepared to be wrong, then it changes things entirely. Because tonally, obviously, it changes things. Words, language, framings, everything becomes different. But you have to be willing to change your mind. I think that's probably the key thing, isn't it? It's like, it doesn't work if you're not willing to change your mind. And are we really willing to change our minds?
Yeah.
Because you're not always right. Okay, we know that. So are you willing to be not proven right?
I mean, obviously, you know, well, I'm always right for everyone else. I think there's a funny paradox at the heart of this. I said this lots of times, that I think the biggest lie is this idea of it's not personal, it's just business. We have this idea of professionalism being sort of non-emotional, right? Don't bring, that's why it's so gendered as well, you know, don't bring all those kind of emotions in there. This is being professional. You know, we are sensible when we're professional, we wear suits and all of that stuff. But actually, when I hear you talking about that, what I'm really hearing is, in fact, the sensible, mature thing to do is to have a conversation about this and have the conflict, but in not act out the conflict, but actually have discuss the conflict. That's that sort of meta communication thing, and that is much more sensible and mature. And those who don't, who kind of use the idea of, well, I'm just being professional, and sweep the emotions under the carpet, end up actually being the opposite, right? Where you end up being terribly unprofessional, or at least by not being human, not being personal, you end up creating this really, really toxic environment, and that has negative professional results, is what I'm saying, or effects. So it's this kind of weird paradox there, that the very thing, well, maybe it's just human nature, but the very thing we're trying to avoid is the thing that's causing us the problem.
It's interesting though, isn't it? It's So I, some years ago, decided my LinkedIn profile should have elements of me outside of work on it, and I'm not, you know, and that, I think that started to happen, and you know, this is well documented over COVID, for example, where, you know, we started to see into and understand and get a glimpse of, and I think that is a good thing, actually. But the thing for me is, because I always have in my head those times where, you know, you had a really good working relationship where disagreement was healthy, where ideas just bounced, where roles disappeared. It really didn't matter. Yeah. Hierarchy was lost because it's in the interest of, you know, getting to the best. And it, you know, it was open, it was free. So I always have that in my head as that only happened because people, you know, opened up. It only happens, actually, I think, when the emotional part is there and understood. And yeah, and you know, there are constraints, you know, but there's an understanding. You have this promise that you've made to each other, that there's trust. And when you raise something and disagree, that it's for good reason. And then, you know, the creativity and the innovation just flows from that. So you've kind of took apart that professional piece, put it to one side, and you're only dealing with the emotional piece, actually, and that's when it works best. But you're right, you've expressed this before, and I really like it, but that's a flip, isn't it? In, you know, putting emotion into your professional work and what you do, and being vulnerable and being willing to say I was wrong. All those things that me as a consultant, maybe I was less comfortable to do that 10 years ago, maybe when I'm younger as well. So maybe I didn't have the gravitas perhaps to say, well, no, I didn't get that right. I think it should be like this. You know, as a young designer, I probably wouldn't have had the courage or the confidence to do that. But I do think it's, yeah, that's a change that I'm putting into play now and have been for some years. And the benefits are so much better. The connections you make with people are so much deeper.
Yeah.
The work
yeah.
and the impact that you can do is far greater.
You said before there are sort of constraints and boundaries to this. I think there is definitely a, I have seen people sort of weaponize that in the other direction where they come in and it's all about them and it's all about their, how they're, you know, and if they're having a bad day, there's someone in particular I'm thinking of and she used to come in and was, you know, made a big thing about how hungover she was and then sort of it would sit down and be like, you know, and it was like flooded this room with this vibe of like, oh, you know, I'm not, it's not my day today. And then of course it just became awful for everyone. And there were no boundaries there that were set. And I've also seen that thing, you know, like I said, I'm married to a psychologist and psychotherapist and the language of therapy. And I don't want to minimize anyone's actual trauma or experiences, bad, toxic workplaces, because there's lots of them.
Yeah.
I'm not saying this at all. I just want to preface this. But the language of, you know, even things like saying that triggered me or I'm traumatized or I feel unsafe. I really want people to be able to say that they feel unsafe and all of those things. But I have seen it then used cynically, I would say, you know, to say, rather than I'm feeling discomfort here and we can explore that, so I feel unsafe and it just shuts the whole thing down. Right. And it's particularly used as a way of kind of bullying upwards. And I understand all the reasons why sometimes you need to kind of to fight upwards and use what you can because there's a power differential there. But I've definitely seen it then go so far the other way that it makes it very, very difficult for people to interact with each other because it's conflict aversion so strong there you can't even begin to have a conversation about the fact that you might be having a conflict, let alone actually go any further than that.
I've presented in the talk Patrick Lencioni's Five Dysfunctions of a Team. I do think it's the simplest if you were to apply some framework to it, because you know when he talks about, okay, so in what you're describing there, Andy, is it and in attention to results. So is that person focused on individual pursuits and not collective success, for example? So I think with Patrick Lencioni's framework, you can start to go, but what is it? Break it down. Is it that there isn't trust here? So people are afraid to disagree. Is it that, you know, there's a lack of commitment because we don't have clear direction and there's a lack of buy-in, so we just can't make decisions that stick? Or is it about accountability? Because when I give this talk, people say, well, one of the things that we disagree on most is people's roles. And we know there's much more disciplines that we're working with in teams. So, but I think you can unpack it. If, you know, probably the scenario you're describing, it's hard even to get to that discussion point. But I do think thinking about, well, where might the problem be? And then having the conversation and even showing, you know, I've used Patrick Lencioni's model and showed it to people where there was disagreement, said, where are we having it? What's the disagreement about? Oh, there's a little bit over here. There's a little bit over here, but it always comes down to the same thing. There's probably a lack of trust and there's probably a fear of conflict. The, you know, the roles, responsibilities, the attention to results and stuff is all stuff you can sort out and should sort out. And that's really valuable because actually if they're not there, that will cause disagreement. But it usually comes down to the human qualities and the foundational competencies that mean you're not having good disagreement.
Yeah, it definitely can help to have a third thing you can point to, I think, rather than, oh, you know, that's just your opinion and stuff. But I think it's also, what I'm also hearing there is how important it is to have some of these conversations up front. And to talk about, you know, certainly when you're forming a project team or any of that stuff, to talk not just about, you know, here's what the project's about and everything, but how do we feel about disagreement? How do we go about resolving that? Are there any particular structures? What are our boundaries? But also the personal stuff of, this stuff's really important to me and this stuff is stuff I need your support on. And
yeah.
I've seen teams where that's worked well, when people have policed each other and someone said, oh, it's okay, you know, I'll stay late to finish this. And the rest of the team said, no, you need to go because we know that on Tuesday nights is yoga or whatever it is.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's really important to you. And that when it works well, like that stuff is really, really super important to have up front. And it can help. You know, again, it's that sort of meta communication idea that we're going to do some work around how we communicate before we are full of all the adrenaline and fear and hormones there that are going to make us then explode. So that when we get to that point, it's like having a good fire extinguisher. Right? It's when we get to that point, we know we know what to do.
So I agree, but I've seen this go wrong actually a few times.
Okay.
So where you, for example, you take a day. Because you've got different organizations starting off on something really big. Mm. And you start to, you know, build that understanding. Maybe you're starting to get people to think about objectively different strengths and weaknesses. But I think it's the things that you can sew into, the routines that are almost more important. So the reminders of, and I've used examples of a simple question at the end of a retro, for example, to say, is there anything here that you're afraid to say? I think if we can start to build that into routines, it becomes, because a great start is good, don't get me wrong,
yeah.
But then it can just be focus on the work, as you say, in the milestones, and it goes into the cadence, and then we've lost it somehow. So I think if you can build it into your routines, and it's totally possible to do that. There's a lovely, from Facilitation at a Glance, that really amazing book, there's a beautiful survey that you can run. It's only 10 questions that you can run with your team to just assess, how are we handling disagreement? And I love that because it's really old. It's beautifully simple. And you could do it at any time just to see, right, is there anything below the surface here that's not being dealt with? Or is there anybody that's afraid to say? So I do think, yes, a good start to surface some of those things can be hard because you might not know some of those things. You might not have that relationship yet, right? You might not have built some trust. So then periodically coming back to that, I think, is really healthy as well.
So this has been fascinating. We're coming up to time. Unfortunately, we could talk about this for ages. We should have recorded the pre-conversation we had where we talked about a load too. As you know, the show is called Power of 10. It's named after the Powers of 10 film by Ray and Charles Eames, all about the relative size of things in the universe. And so the one small question is, or the final question is, what one small thing is either overlooked or could be redesigned that would have an outsized effect on the world?
That's a really hard question, Andy. I love that you asked. There was so much. I was racking my brains over the weekend thinking, and there's so much that I could have talked about. But I think for me, I need to bring it back to the talk. I needed to bring it back to the idea that, you know, we're not doing our best thinking. So taking that first step, there's probably something, if you're in a team and you're doing work today, there's probably something that you're not saying. There's probably some, whether it's big, like an elephant in the room that people are not talking about, or whether it's small, something, maybe an interpersonal thing with a team member that is demotivating you, you're finding it hard. So I think the small thing is just saying it.
Have the conversation.
Seeing how it lands, and then seeing the ripples as maybe somebody else does the same. So for me, the smallest thing that could have the biggest impact is just to start to have those disagreements, to say that thing to, you know, and to not think of that as a negative, because sometimes we give ourselves a hard time and say, oh, I can't say that because of this. Don't think it through so much, actually, in some regards. Just think of it as, you know, this is a step forward. It'll help others. And just remember that you're probably not the only one thinking it. So it's good to say it. So the smallest thing would be just to say that thing that's worrying you, that concern that's there, that issue that's there, that interpersonal thing, that person in the team that you're going, I'm not quite sure. I think we could. And just go for it. I think that's the small thing.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. What I'm also hearing there is a thing around people reflecting from what is it that I'm actually feeling here too, I think, because I think that there's often the surface thing and then what's actually going on there. Yeah. And I think that can help ask those questions or have that conversation without the immediate kind of emotional conflict that sometimes will come with it. So where can people find you online?
So, yeah, it's a complicated question these days with some of the changes in social networks. LinkedIn is probably the easiest way to find me online, to the point that I like to people to know a little bit more about me beyond the professional. My Instagram is actually someplace because I'm a visual person. So that's the other place I direct people to at the moment. But yeah, if you want to contact me, then LinkedIn is best.
Thank you so much. I'll put all the links in the show notes and I'll put a link to those couple of books you mentioned too. Yeah. Thank you so much for being my guest on Power of 10.
Pleasure, Andy. Thank you very much.
You've been watching and listening to Power of 10. You can find more about the show on parlane.com, where you can also check out my leadership coaching practice, online courses, as well as sign up for my irregular newsletter, Doctor's Note. If you have any thoughts, put them in the comments below or get in touch. You'll find me as @apalane on pkm.social. You'll find me at Andy Palane or apalane on LinkedIn or my website. All the links are in the show notes. Thanks for listening and watching, and I'll see you next time.